Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
This is the second day in a row this has happened. It happened yesterday where we have this nifty little plan on all the stuff we're going to talk about. And then, like, I don't know, 30 seconds before the show goes on air, Justin Trudeau drops a bit of a bombshell. We had a little bit more lead time today, and it's not as big a bombshell, but Aaron O'Toole appeared before the Foreign Interference Commission this morning, and he made some comments that I'm like, okay, let me just rearrange some stuff. I'm gonna get it in there. So it will be a bit of a packed show. Welcome everyone to the Andrew Lawton Show on this Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024, Canada's most irreverent talk show here. The big story, I wanted to legitimately follow up on what did come out just before we started the show yesterday. See, a little bit of a look behind the scenes. We do this show live. And part of the reason for that is that it is far much more fun to do the show live, because if something happens, you just roll with it and you have some fun with it. If I just lose the ability to speak, as happens from time to time, believe it or not, I just have to laugh it off. I'm not like, oh, well, maybe edit out that second syllable, or oh, I don't like how I pronounce that word. And then you just have your opportunity one time and one time only. But also in a breaking news context, it's useful. We used to do the show pre-taped. And part of that was just because it was a podcast, and podcasting is generally not an immediate type of format. And Sean is a very diligent editor, so I'd record this great show at 7 a.m. and think, okay, I've got the day off. Let's just go and, you know, tend to the lilies outside. I don't know if we have lilies, and if we do, I've never once tended to them. But anyway, and then she would, oh, yeah, we'll edit it. And then, you know, at 2:30, we're about to hit publish, and oh, what do you know? The core premise of my show has now been, see, I'm losing the ability to speak, has now been trumped by something that happened in the interceding hour. So we do it live, we have fun with it, and I hope you enjoy it as well. But you don't have to listen or watch live. You can catch us in the podcast, on the YouTube, on Facebook at a certain point. If you're in like a foreign country, you might be able to, but you can't in Canada because of Bill C-18. Nevertheless, let's talk a fair bit about, oh yes, or the Andrew Lawton page on Facebook. They haven't yet banned us on that, and I don't want to give them ideas, but if you subscribe to Andrew Lawton on Facebook, which I hope you do, hello, that's me, there is an opportunity you can catch the show there. So yeah, thank you for that, Sean. So let's talk about this immigration thing. So Justin Trudeau yesterday had that remarkable little bit of candor that we shared a clip from. This is a more truncated version of it. We cut out all the fluff and left just the essence of it here that you need to see to get what he's saying. Take a look.
It's really important to understand the context around immigration. Every year, we bring in about 450, now close to 500,000 permanent residents a year. And that is part of the necessary growth of Canada. It benefits our citizens, our communities. It benefits our economy. These are the levels that we have stabilized and grown steadily over the past years, because that's what Canada needs to continue to have a strong economy and strong communities. However, over the past few years, we've seen a massive spike in temporary immigration, whether it's temporary foreign workers or whether it's international students in particular, that have grown at a rate far beyond what Canada has been able to absorb.
Ooh, a massive spike in immigration, and it has been far beyond, not just beyond, not just a little bit beyond, far beyond what Canada has been able to absorb. Now, this is the guy who, as there was an illegal migration crisis underway, he puts out this tweet. We should just have this tweet. To be honest, we should just have it ready. We used to use it so often, that says hashtag welcome to Canada, a tweet that my colleague Candace Malcolm has found through accessed information documents. Legitimately, the department understood was causing people to go to the border illegally because, oh, well, the Prime Minister of Canada said that there's basically this red carpet waiting for us at Roxham Road, so let's just go on in. And this was legitimately spiking illegal immigration in Canada. So this idea that immigration is something that comes with consequences for a country, they can be good consequences or bad consequences, depending on the type of immigration, is something that Canadians apart from Justin Trudeau, have always understood. If you do the Stephen Harper thing and you prioritize economic migration, people that are willing and able to integrate into Canadian society, people who have, oh, you're not allowed to say the word anymore, Canadian values, those people will enhance and improve the fabric of the country. That is when diversity can be your strength as a nation. If you're talking about people that are going to be, for whatever reason, drains on the public system, people that are not going to contribute to Canadian society, people who do not share the fundamental values that Canadian society requires, they will create problems in a country. This is the path available, or the two paths available, when a country is looking at immigration. And there are economic barriers, there are economic considerations, and there are also, of course, considerations that go beyond pure economics. And this is the criticism people have had, even about some of the things that Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre has said on this issue. But right now, this is just on the economic side alone. Justin Trudeau is admitting that we have seen an influx in immigration that has been more than Canada can absorb. More immigrants in this country than we have houses for, than we have jobs for, than we have social services for, than we have healthcare resources for. And all of this he describes as though it's just sort of happened. You just wake up one day and, oh, what do you know? We've had 1.2 million people come into this country every year, including permanent residents and temporary residents. And of course, I mean, the share of the country that is temporary residents has skyrocketed up. It was a few years ago at, I think, 2%. Now it is over 7%. And this has happened on Justin Trudeau's watch, because he actually did not believe or did not accept that there would be adverse consequences to doing this in such a dramatic way. And I know that all the press progress losers are going to take like little bits of discussions like this out of question. This is not a rant against immigration, because it's actually immigrants to this country who are the most poorly served by an immigration system that is as broken as the one over which Trudeau has presided, for two reasons. Number one, because they're coming to the country and this bounty that Canada has been able to offer them, or has told it that it will offer them, is not there for them. And also because when people start to see fractures in the community, what do? They start looking at immigration and its role. And when you have a government that is as aggressive on immigration numbers and turning it into a game, how high can we get the number, as this Liberal government has, it turns Canadians against immigrants. It turns Canadians against the immigration system. Because if your choice is the status quo or no immigration, a lot of people are going to say, well, this certainly isn't working. And if these are the only two alternatives, then I'm going to go with this immigration-averse position. And that's a very dangerous position, because we have a birth rate that is absolutely in dismal territory. Canada's only population growth has come in the last several years through immigration. So let's discuss where this consensus has gone. Half of Canadians, according to one poll, this was, I believe, a Léger poll, say immigration is simply too high. 39% of those polled say that this was something that has attributed to exacerbating housing issues. 21% say immigrants are draining societal resources. Again, this is not about whether these people are right or wrong. It's that that's the perception, and you can't have a pro-immigration consensus in a country when half the population is thinking immigration is too high. You also then have polls of immigrants. This one, also Léger, 84% of immigrants who came to Canada in the past decade say their life is significantly or somewhat more expensive than anticipated. Now, more expensive doesn't mean worse, but it does mean that these people came to this country thinking life was going to be one way and have found that it hasn't actually panned out in that manner. So this is an incredibly important issue. Now, I go back to Justin Trudeau's comments and the critical question, the million-dollar question: why is he throwing himself under the bus? Well, for starters, he's not actually throwing himself under the bus. He's doing the Trudeaupian thing that we know and love because it is so entertaining, where he says it's society that has a learning opportunity. Society has to learn from this. We all have to learn from this. We all have to look in the mirror. He does blackface. It's a learning opportunity for everyone. He gropes a reporter. We all have to do better. It's the same old song and dance. This is an issue where he says Canada has done this. No, your government did this. Your government was the one that made this call. But I think there's a reason that is very deliberate. This was not a gaffe. This was not a slip of the tongue. This was not a misspeak. This was Justin Trudeau carving out a very deliberate position on immigration. And I think one reason that stands out is that he sees this as actually a wedge issue for the Conservatives. He sees that the Conservatives are not all in agreement on this issue. You have Pierre Poilievre doing very, very well among members of a variety of ethnic communities, people who in some cases are very pro-immigration, in some cases are more skeptical of it. But there's a reason that Pierre Poilievre has been a bit reticent on his own beliefs on this, exactly what number the Conservatives would put as their target is something he has not answered. This was a clip, I've shared it before, from my year-ender with Pierre Poilievre back in December.
Immigration, it isn't just housing that needs to be taken into consideration. Yeah. It's also jobs, social services, just geography here. So knowing what you know about the country, do you think those targets from the Liberal government are too high, that 500,000 per year target?
Well, it's not 500. It's, as you know, it's 1.2 million now. The answer is that we have to bring the numbers in line with the number of houses that are built, the amount of the growth in immigration should not exceed the amount of housing stock we add, the number of doctors we add, and the available jobs.
But if you were Prime Minister now, what would that number be? What would your projection be?
I don't have a target for this year, but what I would say is when I launch my platform, it will explicitly link the number, the population growth to the growth in the housing stock, to the growth in the number of doctors and nurses, and to the availability of jobs.
So it could be lower.
It will be mathematically driven, not by arbitrary targets to generate virtue signaling headlines as we have right now. It will be mathematically driven by the growth in the housing stock, the growth in the supply of doctors and nurses to treat people, and the availability of jobs.
But if I were to say to you just the number, a term that you yourself have used in exchanges of this,
I'll be forming government in 2025. And we'll have to set the numbers based on the conditions in that year.
So it was interesting, actually, the fallout from this. There was a lot of Rorschaching going on. You know, the Rorschaching plot test where you look at it and everyone sees what they're going to see, where, you know, conservative supporters were saying, yes, this is a thoughtful, very devoted, clear answer on immigration. And people that are a bit more critical of Pierre Poilievre looked at it and said, he's dodging. He's not saying the number. I see both sides of it. On one hand, he doesn't want to put a random number on the board and say that's the target. But he's saying these are the factors that we will use to get to that target. But again, it's an issue where the Conservatives have had a bit more trepidation than they have on many others. And I've talked about this on the show in the past. It's something that they'll need to deal with. And I think that's why, to go back to Justin Trudeau's motivation, that's why Justin Trudeau is approaching this issue the way he is, because he is seeing that the Conservatives don't actually have one cohesive position on immigration. So if Justin Trudeau can actually outflank the Conservatives on immigration, it will form a bit of a wedge in the Conservative base. The Conservatives will have to somehow scramble for the votes of the ethnic communities that might be pro-immigration, very pro-immigration, and people that are a bit more immigration skeptical. And again, I'm distilling this down into a very crude dichotomy and binary here, which is not. I mean, you can be very pro-immigration and not pro-unfettered immigration. That's what I am. That's what I think most sensible Canadians are, of whatever ethnic or racial background, be they native Canadians or be they people that got here 10 minutes ago. But I think that's what Justin Trudeau is doing. I think he's trying to create a wedge in the Conservatives that they will have to take, put the issue back on Pierre Poilievre, force him to give a number. And the second Poilievre takes the bait, the second Poilievre says that number will be lower than 500,000, Trudeau will have to say, And then all of a sudden, we're going to see that flip once again. But if I were Mark Miller, the immigration minister, I'd be wondering, what exactly is Justin Trudeau saying about your performance there? That is something. Or if I were, I guess, Sean Fraser, who had the file before he got pushed into housing, I would say this is not exactly a ringing endorsement for him. So I want to talk about this Aaron O'Toole business, and I'm going to get to that very shortly, but I want to talk about the firearms file. First and foremost here, we had news from Saskatchewan. They've appointed a new chief firearms officer, which is increasingly important in an era in which provinces are finding they've got some tools in the toolbox to not go along with the federal government's gun grab. Now, I talked about this on the show last week. You may recall the federal government has spent tens of millions of dollars on this buyback, which they announced 4 years ago, and have not yet taken a single gun. Now, from a taxpayer perspective, I say, oh, this is waste. I don't like it. It's inefficient. From a firearms owning perspective, I'm like, oh, that's great. Just keep it going. Keep the boondoggle underway. This was something that we heard from Premier Danielle Smith in Alberta on this.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government has splurged $42 million on its firearm buyback program without confiscating a single firearm to date. Should the federal government try again to implement the program, would your government consider invoking the Sovereignty Act in a bid to protect the property rights of law-abiding Albertans?
Well, I call that a success that they haven't been able to seize a single law-abiding firearms owner's gun. So I wish them continued success at being able to achieve zero compliance with their program. And we are not going to do anything to help them. We believe that the issue is the illegal firearms getting into the hands of gangs and organized crime coming across the border. And the federal government should be focused on that, not focusing on taking guns away from sport shooters, duck hunters, and farmers.
I'd love to see more of this in every province across the country. Provinces often have taken the view that, oh, well, firearms law is criminal, it's federal, but provinces have a fair bit of authority on there, whether it's a loophole or explicit rights you could debate and discuss. But when Alberta said that it would not use police resources to go after firearms, the federal government was kind of screwed because they didn't have another card to play. All they could do was finger wag, and I would say, all right, finger wag all day long. Rod Giltaka is joining us once again. He's the executive director of the Canadian Coalition for Firearm Rights. Rod, this must be a bit conflicting for you too, because on one hand, you're a taxpayer paying for this program, but on the other hand, your guns are still safe for now.
Well, we're certainly in good company with everyone that's angry about Arrive Scam as well, right? So it's everyone is feeling the taxpayer pinch when it comes to the Liberals' incompetence and their corruption. So,
yeah, it's going to be like AR Can is the new government app where you have to, like, you know, log your AR-15s and whatnot. But let me talk to you first and foremost about the provincial response here, because oftentimes I think even firearms advocates have many, it seems like, really just focused on the federal government. And if you get a Liberal government like we have now that's very hostile to gun owners, they kind of just say, all right, well, we're in for a rocky ride here. But this has been a relatively recent advent, it seemed like, where provinces are really stepping up their game and saying no to this.
Well, they are stepping up their game. At least Alberta and Saskatchewan have lined up behind the CCFR and the other applicants in our lawsuit. We're in the appeals process right now, and they are stepping up as interveners. Mm-hmm. So we're really happy to not be going it alone. And those two provinces are really making a statement, I think, for their citizens. And they're saying, you know, what the federal government is doing is unreasonable, not only just in the firearms file, right? But in this case, you know, about guns. And we're not going to stand for it because, you know, we work for you. So I don't know. I'm really happy that we're not standing alone. I'm really happy that governments are doing things in the interest of their citizens. And we're really happy.
I've had on the show Alberta's chief firearms officer, Terry Bryant, who's been like just a tremendous advocate for the sport and a tremendous administrator as well. When I was, you know, waiting like 4 months for my handgun to clear, Alberta was like processing these things in like a week, it seemed like. Now we have in Saskatchewan a new CFO appointed. I don't know if you've had any dealings with Murray Cowan before. I think we're going to have him on the show next week. But what are your expectations there from what Saskatchewan's doing with that firearms office?
Well, my expectations are they're going to continue on doing the great things that they're doing. I had the opportunity to spend a couple of hours with Robert Freeberg, who was their CFO in Saskatchewan, who is now the commissioner of the Saskatchewan Firearms Office. And I tell you, it's just here's a bureaucrat that is thoughtful. And I think the most important thing is he doesn't believe that he's at war with his own citizens and in particular people that would subject themselves to the process of obtaining and maintaining a firearms license. So they've done, I think, in that province as well as Alberta, focused on the most important aspects of the firearms office or the duties of the CFO, which is to increase compliance with the Act and regulations and work towards increased public safety. That's really the mandate, not in enforcement and prosecution of licensed gun owners, which is what the federal government right now is focused on. So, you know, at the end of the day, we think that owning firearms legally is really important and that there's a regulatory framework around that and ensuring the public is safe as a, you know, in light of that, but focusing on where violent crime really comes from, which is gangs. There's a domestic violence aspect to it. And it's a lot of that stuff is fueled, almost all of it is fueled by smuggling and illegal manufacturing.
Now, when we talk about provinces appointing their own CFOs, just to go back to the civics of this for a moment, what is it that a CFO can do differently? Because yes, the core regulations, the core law is federal, but we see wildly different experiences in different provinces depending on their CFO. So what is it that they can really do that is more favorable to people like you and I?
Well, in the case of Saskatchewan, they passed their own Firearms Act. And what it did, so I'll give you one example. It's quite complicated. I don't claim to know everything, but I'll give you one example. In the Firearms Act, if you store your firearm in a way that is in contravention with the Firearms Act, it's a criminal offense. It triggers a criminal code charge immediately. So that will basically, for a law-abiding citizen, destroy their lives, basically. It's a weapons charge. And that might be as innocuous as, you know, my guns are in the safe, but I may not have, or in a locked case, but I may not have put a secure locking device on the firearm, or I forgot that. Or I left a magazine in a gun safe. Like those result in life-destroying criminal charges. So Saskatchewan has said, you know what, maybe it's a case of making sure people are in compliance and providing education and some motivation for them to make sure that they're storing their firearms correctly. And in the case of, let's say, handguns, these are registered firearms held by people that get a criminal record check every single day electronically, right? Mm-hmm. So this is not a criminal enterprise. Saskatchewan Firearms Act does is it takes that offense that was a federal criminal offense in the criminal code and turns it into a regulatory offense. So they'll face a fine or maybe even seizure of their firearms until they take a course or what have you. So there's reasonable remedial action in incorporated into that, and people don't get their lives destroyed for an administrative oversight. So these are some of the things that a forward-thinking, reasonable chief firearms officer can get going in their own province and you know, reside over a regime that's far more reasonable and proportionate, I would say.
You mentioned the lawsuit that the Saskatchewan and Alberta governments have joined as interveners. Now, I should say, when you're David going up against Goliath, you know, an organization which, you know, may be a very robust organization, but you're going up against a government, it's good to know at least you have some governments on your side, at least in some way here. So that's in the appeal. What's the essence of the argument on this case?
Well, probably the most important one is the administrative aspect of our argument. So in the criminal code, it clearly says that the government can't ban firearms that are appropriate for hunting and sporting use. And it was written in there for a reason. It's not an accident that it's in there. The government decides, well, you know what? We're going to violate that. And we think we have the administrative authority just to override the criminal code using an order in council. We're not even going to, you know, we're not going to need legislation or anything for that kind of stuff. We're just going to do it. Especially when it's on the heels of something like the spree shooting in Nova Scotia. They thought, well, you know what? Nobody's going to push back against us, and we're just going to do this thing. So we sued the government for that reason. The federal court judge in the case said, oh yeah, well, the government can pretty much do whatever it wants, even if it doesn't have the authority to do what it's supposed to do. We disagree with that ruling. Our legal team, which is one of the best in the country, said, we should have won on this. There's no reason why we should have lost. There are a lot of independent people out there that said, you absolutely should have won this. We're appealing it because we might suppose there's all kinds of monkey business going on there. And at least we have the Department of Justice in two Canadian provinces that agree we should have won that administrative aspect. So they're lining up behind us. So, you know, it was the government overstepping its authority. Not the first time we saw this government doing that, but hopefully we get a proper resolution this time.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eyes peeled on that as it works its way through the process. Rod Giltaka, always a pleasure, sir. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
All right. I mentioned, so it's actually a good segue here because I want to talk about the 2021 election and Aaron O'Toole, a name we probably haven't heard for a little while. He was the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada. Before that, he was the true blue, rock-ribbed, ironclad conservative that was going to be the unflinching conservative, true blue, as he said, against the squishy, moderate, red Tory Peter MacKay. That was the narrative of the 2020 Conservative leadership race. Aaron O'Toole wins, and in 2021, he forgets everything he said in 2020 when he campaigned in the leadership on defunding CBC. He campaigned in 2021 on, well, maybe we just commission a report that's going to look at the business model of CBC and see if there are ways to modernize it. When he said in the leadership he would be unflinching in conscience rights for members of parliament, in 2021, he said, if you're running on this platform, you better fall in line. When he said in 2020 that he was the pro-freedom candidate, he said everything the opposite of that when COVID and vaccine mandates came. You may recall in 2022, when the Freedom Convoy, this is after he had lost the 2021 election, the Freedom Convoy was on its way to Ottawa, and Aaron O'Toole was asked about these demands that truckers were making to lose the vaccine mandate, and he said, all right, we support truckers. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to set up vaccine clinics at truck stops. Yeah, you really got him there. So this was Aaron O'Toole. Now, Aaron O'Toole made some profound just blunders in that 2021 election. He flip-flopped on policies. He flip-flopped on his position on guns. He was pro-gun, and then he was pro-gun control. He flipped on so much in that election, much of it within the span of just like a few questions from reporters. That would be enough to get him to roll on policies that were literally in the printed, bound, glossy, laminated platform books. And then he gets asked about it. He's like, oh yeah, no, we're going to take that. Literally, they took out a section on firearms from the platform that had already been sent out because he got a couple of nasty questions from, I don't know, the Toronto Star or whatever. So this is all the lead up to this morning, when Aaron O'Toole took the stage before the Commission on Foreign Influence in Canadian Elections, and he said why it is that he really lost in 2021. Take a look.
So what was your understanding then, based on the modeling on election day, of where the Conservatives would end up in terms of seats that day?
Yeah, reliving those last few days of the campaign. We went from winning the seat count a week before the election with a small, modest minority to, on election day, losing the seat count and still winning the popular vote. We saw the vote changing largely on the vaccine and the vaccine mandate issue. But on election night, when we knew we were going to lose, my campaign manager had said, our models and how the vote goes, you should end up with about 127, 128 seats, which will be a historic level for opposition. And when you consider it was a pandemic election, we were largely on the wrong side of public opinion on the vaccine mandate issue, which is, in my view, why the Prime Minister called the election. That was being briefed to me to say, calm down, you did okay. You'll be able to live to fight another day and stay on as leader. So I went in that night feeling, okay, we're going to end up with 127, 128 seats. And as returns were coming in that night, not that I asked for any detail, but that night there was already clear indication that a number of ridings were vastly outside of our modeling window, and the ridings were the same ridings that we had been complaining about.
So the interference stuff is, by the way, completely accurate. Yes, the Conservatives were targeted by the Chinese regime in 2021 in the ridings in which there is ample evidence to suggest that interference took place. It was not enough that it would have swayed the overall result. But it would be very easy. It would be very convenient and nice and probably help Aaron O'Toole sleep at night to say that, oh, his loss was everyone else's fault. His loss was China's fault. His loss was the vaccine mandate's fault. He says in that clip that the Conservatives were on the wrong side of the vaccine mandate issue. Now, what he means is that the Conservatives were wrong to oppose vaccine mandates. Now, there's a premise embedded in that, which is that the Conservatives really did oppose vaccine mandates. Now, yes, technically, when Justin Trudeau came out and said that he wanted vaccine mandates for the civil service to get on planes, the Conservatives did take a softly critical position of that. But when they criticized it, they weren't dealing with the essence of the issue. They weren't actually saying, this is fundamentally wrong. You can't deny people civil liberties. You can't force this on people. No, they were pussyfooting around it. They were saying, well, yeah, you know, we don't like it. Same as when the trucker mandate came in. They weren't saying this is fundamentally wrong. They're saying, well, I mean, supply chains are already pretty rough and, you know, it's the grocery store shelf. Like, they weren't dealing with the issue in the way that it needed to be dealt with. If anything, the Conservatives just went along with this line that, well, he's politicizing vaccines. We don't want to talk about them. It's they shouldn't be political. It's too important. So he was accepting the liberal premise on a lot of these very damaging and very dangerous COVID policies. Now, let me be perfectly frank when I point out that I think a lot of Canadians did support what Justin Trudeau was doing. I've lamented that fact on a number of occasions. Canadians were calling bylaw enforcement officers on their neighbors. Canadians did re-elect Justin Trudeau. But the problem was not that the Conservatives were too anti-vaccine mandate. If anything, the problem was that they were not anti-vaccine mandate enough. But moreover, I don't buy the fact that the change in fortunes for the Conservatives was largely or even minimally because of the vaccine issue. No, it was because the Conservatives had a leader which could not articulate what the Conservatives believed, what he believed. They had a leader who would flip on anything he had said even a year and a half earlier about what he would do if he were elected prime minister. And more importantly, the amount of daylight between him and Justin Trudeau had just shrunk to a tiny little sliver of a glimmer by the end of the campaign. So this idea that we could just look everywhere else but inward to figure out why the Conservatives lost the election is a very convenient path for Erin O'Toole, but it is historic revisionism at its worst. This is an issue. I'm ambushing my next guest because I didn't say that I was going to talk about this, but I feel Tom Morazzo's up on this. He's a retired captain with the Canadian Armed Forces and author of the book, The People's Emergency Act, and joins me now. Tom, you must remember that when O'Toole comes out, the trucks are on their way to Ottawa, and he says, all right, I got this, guys. Vaccine clinics at truck stops. That's the answer to the mandate. Oh, you're muted there. Nope, we're still can't hear you there. All right, we'll get that sorted out in just a moment. But what I was going to talk to Tom about, and we'll get to this as well, is this story, actually quite a dismal story that we have talked about in the past. Soldiers are increasingly reliant on food banks. These are soldiers, men and women, who put on a uniform to serve their country and do so incredibly courageously, not for a huge amount of money, but Canada has not even provided the bare necessities to these people. We've had reports, one in the Ottawa Citizen that came out, where Canadian Forces personnel had to rely on food donations while undergoing training in Ottawa because of high living costs there and a lack of support from the military. We also see that in New Brunswick, demand has been doubling at food banks, in large part because of the Canadian Forces base in Gagetown. The food bank there has reported a doubling of the number of military personnel seeking assistance. This goes back to the beginning of COVID. I think I hear rumblings from what sounds like Tom Morazzo's microphone there. So we'll get Tom back on here. Tom, I think I can hear you now. So
okay.
We'll get to the food bank stuff, but just, I mean, Erin O'Toole's revisionism that the Conservatives, first off, took a strong position against vaccine mandates in 2021, but then that they lost because of that is just baffling to me.
Yeah, that was extremely frustrating to me personally, but also a lot of people that I know. And, you know, going back to the convoy itself, I remember, and I was quite surprised by it, the fact that the Conservative Party used the actual convoy protest in Ottawa as a means to dethrone Erin O'Toole from the party. So initially, we took that as a very, very positive action on behalf of the Conservative Party. And then Candace Bergen became the interim leader. She did a photo op with a couple of truckers the next day, went into the House of Commons and said, basically, okay, truckers, you've proved your point. Now go home. right? Which we saw as a massive slap in the face. And you know, I'm not here to bash conservatives overall. I've done enough of that, you know, as of late. But, you know, it was very frustrating because we thought that there was going to be an opportunity where the Conservative Party, the official opposition to the Canadian government, were going to get our back. And that's not what happened at all. In fact, they used us for their own personal political gain. And I think the convoy itself was an opportunity for the Conservatives to dump the leader that they really had a lot of buyer's remorse from. But we weren't the beneficiaries of that. So in a sense, my takeaway is that the convoy itself was very convenient for the Conservatives, but it wasn't overall helpful to the rest of Canada at that time, especially not the 6 million unvaccinated Canadians.
Yeah, I take a bit more of a sympathetic view of Candace Bergen's position than you did. I don't know what's in her mind on that, but what I took from what she was saying was that you guys didn't have a champion in the political system. Now you do. And I don't, you know, you could debate and haggle over whether that was an accurate position, but I think that the convoy showed that there had been no real leader in the political system. And I've given credit to Maxime Bernier for being the only political figure in that election that was doing it. But when I say in the system, I'm talking about the fact that no PPC member of parliament had been elected, and that includes Maxime Bernier. And, you know, the problem is that you had this groundswell that caused the convoy. And then you had the convoy itself, which caused a lot of other people to look around and say, oh, these guys are right. And what's fascinating there is that it was only then that the Conservatives started to take on this issue. Is that old, you know, line about, you know, I need to know where my people are going so I can lead them. And that was really where the Conservatives were on this. So I think you're right to point out that they only took that position when other people, including you, had laid that groundwork and showed that, hey, there is actually a movement.
Yeah. And I, you know, a lot of frustration people had, and this is a comment, and I'm going to be fair to Pierre Poilievre. When he does things I don't like, I call it out, but I have to be fair to him. A lot of people attack him because they say, where were you during the mandates, the lockdowns and all that stuff? But the thing is, you know, people like him, he was not the leader of the Conservative Party. He was the finance critic. And he did an absolutely exceptional job at his portfolio, which was to criticize Trudeau in the finances. Had he been maybe the critic for, you know, Health Canada or maybe one of the other departments, then you could kind of say that, right? So we had this sort of glimmer of hope that maybe when he came in, he was going to be, more of that fight that he has had, but he's become more sort of fixated on sort of smaller issues, not necessarily going back in time and looking at, you know, issues to me that are important, like, you know, investigating what happened during the COVID lockdowns, investigate several of those things, all related specifically to COVID-19. I would like to see more of that stuff. So, you know, I think Canadians expect a lot from conservatives. You know, I think what we need is somebody as intelligent as Pierre Poilievre, because he's a very intelligent person, very articulate, can get his point across much better than what I'm doing currently at the moment. But at the same time, you know, we want somebody who is bold, somebody who is strong, somebody that can say, you can look at that person and say, yeah, that guy's got my back. Like, that guy is the guy that I'm going to go stand behind when it comes to something really, really difficult. But I think that they've been overly cautious. I don't think they've been bold enough until recently. I think people like Larry Brock. Larry Brock, without a doubt, is my favorite conservative member of parliament because he's tough. He's bold. He's very decisive. He's aggressive in his pursuits. That is what I would imagine to embody conservative politicians right now in this time. But we're seeing a little bit, you know, I think it's changing. I'm seeing some signs of changing. I just don't see that they came at the right time. I think the conservatives have been too conservative in moving forward with things that are important to average Canadians like myself.
No, and that's fair. And again, you actually were incredibly good on that, considering I gave you zero notice until I asked the question that I was going to ask you about that. But the issue I wanted to talk about leans on your experience as a veteran in the Canadian Armed Forces. We've had, just a couple of more reports. This is not a new problem by any stretch of veterans relying on food banks. And listen, I mean, there is a big place in my heart for men and women who serve. And, you know, notwithstanding issues that I've talked about on the show with, you know, morale in the Canadian Armed Forces and lowering standards and all of that, people that do that for whatever reason deserve commendation. But they're not even getting the bare minimum, which is the ability to buy food. Why is this problem happening, first off?
Well, I would definitely say it's the same experience right across Canada. It is this inflationary pressure that has been brought on by, you know, the government. I mean, the government controls monetary and fiscal policy, and the things that we've seen over the last 8 years are horrendous. Now, this, like you said, is not a new problem. I can remember back as far as 1999. So I had joined the regular force military in September of 1998. And Maclean's magazine put out this very scathing review on the state of the Canadian military. They did a story about a young second lieutenant. He was going through to become a pilot, but he was working in the mall in Saskatchewan as a part-time security guard because he was trying to feed his family. You know, there's somebody who wants to serve, but they can't afford to serve. Now, even in my own case, you know, there was a time I was just desperate. I wanted to join the regular force military, and I was thinking seriously about joining as an enlisted non-commissioned member. But I looked at it, I'm like, I can't afford to do that because of all the student loans that I have. And this is going back into the late 90s. And I was already an enlisted person in the reserves at the time, you know, but that Maclean's article that came out saw a sweeping change across the pay and the compensation for the Canadian military. You know, my rank level at the time that article came out was also second lieutenant. And that April, I saw my pay go up just over 14%. But, you know, many of the other ranks had much smaller pay increases. So, you know, the attempt or the justification at the time was to say, oh, we want to make it sort of on an even playing field as firefighters and maybe police officers. But I don't think that the Canadian Forces has ever been able to meet that standard. And there's one big reason why that happens. And, you know, that article you're talking about in New Brunswick, I lived in Oromocto. I lived in military housing in Oromocto in the late 1999 and up to 2001. I lived in Petawawa. But there's something that does happen. Okay, so imagine you're a young soldier in New Brunswick, okay, where the cost of living in New Brunswick at a certain time was much, much lower than, say, Toronto. Well, I was posted to Toronto in 2008. I was posted to Toronto. And there's no military housing in a place like Toronto. Okay, so you have to live on the economy. So the government came up with this scheme, or the military, where they were paying people something called PLD. It's a cost of living differential. And it was about $1,500 if you were posted to Toronto on top of your pay. But it was also taxed, right? It goes on to your gross income. So really what it comes down to is you're getting about $900, maybe $800 to live in somewhere around the GTA. Okay, years ago,
and that would have to cover a housing differential and also food, you know, costs. Correct?
Yes, absolutely, it does.
So that was an all-in. Oh wow.
Yeah. So a lot of people were reluctant to say, "Hey, I don't want to get posted to Toronto from, say, Petawawa, where the cost of living is pretty decent, where I could live in military housing." So when I lived in Gagetown, I was in military housing. My rent on a military, we call them PMQs, private military quarters, was $400 a month plus utilities. Okay. And that's controlled by CFHA, which is Canadian Forces Housing Authority or Association, whatever it is. I don't know what the agency. So CFHA was controlling that. But then the Treasury Board got involved eventually with CFHA, and they said, hey, These are government assets, and according to Treasury Board rules, you need to now start charging fair market value for that housing. Okay, so this puts another pressure on soldiers and their families, because now they have to pay fair market prices for those homes in those areas. Now, it's very, very difficult to do that when, you know, you go from a place like Petawawa, where you're paying local prices on homes, or Oromocto, New Brunswick, where I was. Now, all of a sudden, you're getting sent to Calgary, or you're getting sent to Edmonton, or you're getting sent to large cities. What about to Quebec City, where you're posted? Now you have to pay those local, like, military housing is no longer a means for you to equalize your federal pay across the country, because the cost of living is very different from different military base to different military base to different base. So you're either going to move into very old and not so great military housing and pay fair market value prices, or you're just going to go buy a house in the economy in the local area, right? And now if you purchase a house 2-3 years later, you could be posted to another place and have to sell your house and get a new mortgage and do all that. So it's, you know, very difficult for Canadian Forces members to make these rapid changes every 3 to 4 years if they're being posted somewhere, because housing in Canada affects not just soldiers who don't have affordable military housing anymore. They have the same fair market prices that everyone else has. So it's difficult when your pay isn't increasing very much.
Yeah, and you're right to point out that a lot of these are general issues. I know there are a lot of people who aren't in the military listening and say, yeah, I'm using a food bank. I'm having these difficulties. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, I'm sympathetic to that. Soldiers are in a very different spot, though, because the demands that are being placed on them because of the job. I mean, in the private sector, if you're getting moved around a lot, oftentimes you're able to bargain for something in that that's going to cover that expectation. One of the other considerations as well, if you've got a spouse, that spouse is being carted around the country as well, which means they're less likely to be able to build up their own career, which will earn enough of an income to offset this, because they're getting relocated as well. So, you know, very few military spouses are able to do what they would have to or be able to do if their spouse were anything other than a soldier.
And that's a very, very important point. So if you were to go to a place like CFB Petawawa, which is, you know, not too far, I think it's about 2 hours northwest of Ottawa. That is a very small community. The next community over, the biggest one, is Pembroke, Ontario. And that's where a lot of the spouses would go to try to find employment. Okay, but guess what?
Which has 14,000 people in Pembroke, by the way. I just looked that up as you said that.
Yeah, and you know what? Pembroke, a great little town, but the issue in Pembroke is nobody in Pembroke changes jobs. The joke used to be you either retire or you die in the position you've got in Pembroke. Hmm. Nobody, no employer wants to invest time hiring a military spouse, knowing that in, you know, 2 to 4 years, they're going to have to replace that person. And this is a real phenomenon. Mm. So the only people I knew that ever got hired, like spouses, were if they were lawyers and if they were teachers, because, you know, there's a teacher getting posted out with her military spouse, male or female, or a lawyer, and then a new one is coming into town. So the jobs were very, very difficult in a place like Petawawa to get employment. Now, if you're in Oromocto, New Brunswick, you've got to drive 20 kilometers and hope you can get a job in Fredericton. If you're in Toronto, it's a little bit different because it's not a military town. Edmonton, St. Hubert, I think, is the area that's around CFB Edmonton. These are the different dynamics at play. And you're right, it really does harm the career opportunities for a spouse. I mean, look at the effect it would have on a pension for somebody who has to quit their job every 2 to 4 years. And if you're an officer's wife, it could be a lot shorter than that. You know, my average posting was, I did 12 cities in 24 years, you know, so you're really moving around quite a bit, and it's hard for spouses to earn a long-term pension. You know, that's another dynamic to this.
Yeah. No, very, very well said. Tom, thank you so much, as always, for coming on. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks, Andrew. Thank you.
All right. Tom Morazzo, author of the book, The People's Emergency Act. And he rolled with the punches there, took on another topic, which I appreciate on the fly. That does it for us for today. We'll be back tomorrow with more of Canada's most irreverent talk show. See you in, what are we at, 23 hours and 10 minutes by this point. So we'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you. God bless. And good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.